November 1986.
Well, I'll tell you, last year there was a very exciting first here at our parade, the dramatic arrival of the Masters of the Universe Princess of Power Float, furnished by Mattel. And here to describe the action this year is the star of the new Masters of the Universe feature film, the very dapper, the very tall, Dolph Lundgren.
Thank
Dolph.
God. Where's Vanna?
She couldn't make it, I'm sorry.
Now here again is the dramatic Castle Grayskull. In this setting, He-Man battles the forces of evil.
It's the final day of November, and I know that Thanksgiving was last week, but this clip was just too good to pass up. I have never seen a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade float have commentary from an actor that was scripted like this. Dolph Lundgren was here to promote the Masters of the Universe film, which didn't come out till almost an entire year later, in August of 1987. This was a movie that had an insane production story. It was produced by Canon Films, but Mattel was also supposed to help finance half of the film. And when it came time for Mattel to pony up and pay their half, they outright refused. So the movie ran out of money, and the director had to finance the film's final battle between Dolph Lundgren's He-Man and Frank Langella's Skeletor with a skeleton crew. No pun intended there. There is a documentary about Canon Films that covers a lot of the story of that film, so you could check that out there, but it's a wild story. And it's one of my all-time favorite bad movies.
Together, He-Man and She-Ra will fight evil, and they will...
Welcome to Dance of Days.
I'm a real wild one. Wild one.
Josie's on a vacation far away.
How is everyone doing? I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, if you celebrated. I planned on having this episode out before Thanksgiving, but the timing didn't quite work out, so better late than never, here we are. So apologies if I sound a little scratchy or congested. I've picked up my second cold of the fall season. This is pretty rare for me. I don't usually get sick this close together, but I assume after, you know, a couple years of wearing masks regularly and not getting sick for almost 3 years, my immune system isn't what it used to be. So I'm channeling my inner Dave Brown here, and I have my cup of tea, and hopefully that will help. We'll see how my voice holds up. I hope you've been enjoying the Dance of Days series, and if this is your first time hearing it, no worries. You can listen to any of these in any order. It doesn't really matter. The premise of the series, though, is I'm doing a deep dive on the year 1986, and a year that I previously thought was very bad, and trying to find the albums that were good from that year. So if you haven't heard any earlier episodes, we have covered Dag Nasty's Can I Say, Husker Du's Candy Apple Gray, New Order's Brotherhood, Yola Tango's Ride the Tiger, and the Ramones' Animal Boy. We did that on the first episode. And the second episode was a spooky Halloween-themed episode, where I covered D. Kreutzen's October File, New Model Army's The Ghost of Cain, The Mission's God's Own Medicine, Samhain's November Coming Fire, and The Cramps' A Date with Elvis. So I've got five more albums here from 1986 that I'm going to talk about today. And if those sound interesting, check them out. I love this series. I love what I've been able to find doing this show. So I hope you enjoy them. A few episodes back, I think I said I would mention the albums that I listened to that I probably won't be devoting episodes to. So here's a couple of them that I've got through from 1986. All right, so I have listened to The Age of Quarrel by the Cro-Mags. I just did not like this record. I know it's a classic hardcore record. I'm not a huge fan of New York hardcore, though there is a New York hardcore record that I might actually get to one day, so I'll save that for later. But yeah, not Age of Quarrel. It's probably one of the most overrated records of 1986, if I'm being completely honest. I did listen to Enjoy by The Descendants, and I think it's the worst Descendants record. Some people have argued with me, but with any record that has multiple songs about farting and toilet humor. That's a loser in my book. Gross. I listened to Sinos by Soda Stereo. They're a Latin alternative rock band. It was fine. Nothing really to write home about. I listened to Noah Alexandria by Sikiera. This was a Polish post-punk band. Very Joy Division-y and a little Kraftwerk in there too. Again, it was fine. Nothing to write home about. Medusa by Clan of Xymox. Post-punk goth rock record. Llegandos Los Monos by Sumo. Another Latin American band. Solid record. I listened to the self-titled Camper Van Beethoven album. This is actually like their third album. They have another record in 86 that I may get to one day, though. I gave Timbuk3's album Greetings from Timbuk3 a listen because I wanted to feature it on this episode, but it just wasn't strong enough. Future So Bright Gotta Wear Shades is a monster hit, and not anything else on that album really stands out very much. So it got cut from this one. I listened to Brighter Than a Thousand by Killing Joke. They're a post-punk band from the UK. Kind of influential on a lot of later bands. It was fine. I listened to the new record by My Bloody Valentine, which was a little EP that they put out in 86. I was surprised to see they had stuff that early. It was fine, but just really short. I also listened to The Peel Sessions by Joy Division. This was, you know, a posthumous release. I wasn't going to feature it just because, you know, it's a Peel Session. It's nothing new, but it's good. It's very well done. I thought about doing Love and Rockets Express for the Halloween episode, but it just missed me. I don't know. It was fine. The post-Bauhaus band. And there's a couple things I won't do on the show because I've already done them in depth previously. Firehose released Raging Full On. We did them on our Challengeography, where we tried to listen to every Firehose record, which we did. And that's on our Patreon, so I didn't really want to go back over that one again. I wasn't going to do Zig Zig Sputnik's Flaunt It again. We talked about that also on a Patreon. I think we did it on an I'm Listening fun record. We've done an episode on Bedtime for Democracy by the Dead Kennedys with Justin from the band Sweat and Graf Orlok and Ghost Limb. So there's a whole episode on that one. There's also a whole episode on Break Down the Walls by Youth of Today, which Dylan and I did. And Tinderbox by Susie and the Banshees also came out in 86. We won't do that one either because we did a Best Worst Over Under with Anne Lepore on Susie and the Banshees' entire discography. So we talked pretty in-depth about that album there. So that's about all of them that I want to talk about for now. There's a couple there that I may bring up in the future that I skipped over, but we'll see. We'll get to them. And if I wind up, you know, never doing them, then I'll talk about them on here like this. All right, so let's dive into the show. The first album I'm going to talk about today is Guitar Town by Steve Earle. American singer and songwriter who got his start in Nashville, Tennessee, as a songwriter for other artists like Guy Clark, Johnny Lee, and Carl Perkins. He released his debut EP Pink and Black in 1982, and then he signed to Epic Records and recorded a neo-rockabilly album that was not released. I think some of those tracks wound up on a compilation of early material, though. So he got out of his contract with Epic and then signed a 7-record deal with MCA Records, which leads us to this album. This is his debut full length. It was released March 5th, 1986 on MCA Records. The personnel is Steve Earle on guitar and vocals. He is joined by his backing band, The Dukes, which consists of Bucky Baxter on pedal steel guitar, Richard Bennett on guitar and 6-string bass, Ken Moore on keys and synths, Emery Gordy Jr. on bass and mandolin, and Harry Stinson on drums. The album was produced by Emery Gordy Jr., Tony Brown, and Richard Bennett. Gordy and Brown were members of Emmylou Harris's bands, and Bennett played with Neil Diamond and Mark Knopfler as a touring musician. So I went with this album because originally, for my November episode, I wanted to cover mostly country and folk artists. For some reason, Thanksgiving makes me want to listen to down-home country music. I'm probably equating that to childhood Thanksgivings where I visited family in Georgia, going to see my great-great-grandmother, Granny Roach, who was born in a covered wagon coming across the mountains back from the west. So my family goes back pretty far, I assume, if they were able to go west and then return back east. But yeah, I get nostalgic during this time of year. I get more nostalgic at Thanksgiving than I do for Christmas. There's just something about this holiday. Fall is my favorite holiday. Thanksgiving's usually not too cold. The leaves have been turned. You know, usually it's really pretty. Weather's almost always nice on Thanksgiving here in North Carolina. I don't know about in other places, but here it's usually clear. November's a typically dry month. So yeah, I was going to do all country or more southern style music. There's a little bit of that left here, but I didn't devote the entire episode to it like I had originally intended. So for those of you who don't like country or folk, you'll probably be happy to know that I didn't devote the whole episode to that. But it's, you know, I'm from the South, so I have an appreciation for this kind of stuff. So Guitar Town topped the Billboard country charts and hit number 89 on the Billboard 200. This album earned Steve Earle 2 Grammy nominations, one for Best Male Country Artist and another for Best Country Song. The tracks Hillbilly Highway, Guitar Town, Someday, and Goodbye's All We Got Left were all singles from this album. Guitar Town and Goodbye's were both top 10 hits on the country charts. AllMusic's Mark Deming wrote, "Guitar Town is slightly flawed by an overly tidy production from Emery Gordy Jr. and Tony Brown, as well as a band that never hit quite as hard as Earl's voice, and he would make many stronger and more ambitious records in the future. But Guitar Town was his first shot at showing a major audience what he could do, and he hit a bullseye. It's perhaps the strongest and most confident album any country act released in the 1980s. LA Times, written in 1986, wrote, "Though not a true concept album, the LP is a contemporary portrait of working class aspirations and frustrations. Rather than operate as a traditionalist like newcomer Dwight Yoakam, Earl edges into new territory, much like a younger, more liberal Merle Haggard. He's nowhere near the classic country singer that Haggard is, but Earl exhibits the same ability to express the working class milieu." Multiple reviews at this time would bring up the fact that Earl would play with Dwight Yoakam one night, The Replacements the next, and then George Jones after that. All these sounds kind of swirl together, and it gives you an idea of what Steve Earle's music is like, especially during this time. It's considered one of the best country albums of 1986, and you can hear elements of his earlier rockabilly sound all over this record. There is a very 80s production quality to it, so it doesn't have the most timeless feel to it, but the songwriting stands very strongly. If these were recorded today, you'd be like, hell yeah, these songs are great. There's no way we shouldn't record these. Some tracks that stand out to me, Goodbye Is All We Got Left has this piano part to it that makes me think of some of the Bob Seger's tunes from the 70s and 80s. Little Rock and Roller is a song on here about Steve Earle calling home and talking to his son, Justin Towns Earle, as a toddler. This song is especially heartbreaking considering Justin Towns Earle grew up to be a musician in his own right, who passed away in 2020 at the age of 38. I imagine this song is probably tough for Steve to sing now. Rolling Stone magazine ranked it number 489 on their list of the 500 greatest albums of all time in 2003. And then Steve Earle would go on to release his biggest album ever in 1988, Copperhead Road. He would also go on to release 21 albums, including this year's album, Jerry Jeff. Steve Earle has had a very wild life, including getting married half a dozen times, going to jail, getting into drugs, getting sober, acting on TV shows like The Wire and Tremé. His story is bonkers. And if you want to hear more, I highly recommend that you check out the Unpops music series on Steve Earle, which is part of the Unpopular Opinion podcast network. Friend of the show Andy Sell is one of the co-hosts of that, and it's one of my favorite series of podcasts ever. They've covered Limp Bizkit, Korn, Nirvana, Oasis, Steve Earle, and now they're working on Fleetwood Mac. I love this series. It's so funny. But yeah, Steve Earle's life is just a roller coaster of wild, wild stories. I cannot recommend that podcast enough. But yeah, I really enjoyed this record. I'm probably not the biggest mainstream country listener. I just don't have a ton of knowledge about that sound, especially in like the 80s. I considered doing Dwight Yoakam's album from that year. I may get to it one day, but that would be another one to really devote. But it was kind of a thin year for country. I looked at all the big names, and it was a lot of like older names releasing their not best material, or names that are big, but they hadn't quite hit their big sound. Like there's like a Reba McEntire record that year that she hadn't quite hit her big sound yet. There's like an Emmylou Harris record that year, like some Johnny Cash, not great Johnny Cash. But yeah, I really enjoyed this record. Steve Earle's an interesting person, and I've heard other albums by him, and I do enjoy them. So any Steve Earle is worth checking out, I think. All right, our next album, completely opposite direction. It is Equalizing Distort by Gauze.
Gauze, Gauze, Gauze above!
Gauze were a hardcore band from Japan that formed in 1981. According to the band, the goal of the group was to play as fast as possible. Their first 10 songs were released on the compilation City Rocker in 1982. They then released their debut full-length in 1985, titled Fuckheads. Released in March on Selfish Records in Japan, this is the band's second album. And the personnel on this record is Fugu on vocals, Momorin on guitar, Shin on bass, and Hiko on drums. I've talked about the Stalin before when I talk about Japanese hardcore on the podcast, and the Stalin are probably the most important Japanese punk and hardcore band before Gauze, though Gauze probably is now the most important hardcore band from Japan. I found this quote from a translation on their website by the bassist Shin, and he said, "We resolutely criticize organizations and others who use this industry to make a lot of money for their own profits, make up people who don't know anything more than necessary, and run into commercialism." That's a Google Translate, so I don't know how accurate that fully is, but it kind of encapsulates Gauze's identity. They were very much a DIY anti-corporate band, definitely borrowing from the Discord and SST school of releasing music. I read a Vice article that said, "Gauze's idea of hardcore is not sophisticated. It is a blunt instrument. There are no guitar solos, no frills, simply high-speed, tuneless ranting. Unlike much Japanese hardcore, it is not big. Gauze blows you away, not with 200 Marshall stacks and a fuck ton of dry ice, but through expertly honed riffs and pneumatic precision. The simple goal appears not to be so much to entertain the audience as to outlast and overload them. In the great tradition of punk's antagonism towards its audience, this may be the most subtle and cruel approach of all." So news coming out of Japan says that Gauze have finally decided to call it a day. And this was my final motivation to break my theme of all country and folk, because I thought I should talk about Gauze now while they are calling it a day. So I had heard Gauze before, but because they never released any of their music in the U.S. officially, I would always have to rely on YouTube streams. So I'm not as familiar with their discography as I could be. But I knew already of their importance and the respect that they had and the inspiration that they created in hardcore, especially in Japan, but also over here. And this record rules. It's so special sounding. When I saw it on the list for 1986, I was really excited to get to it, because what I knew about Gauze, I knew they were a unique band for this time period. The album clocks in at under 18 minutes. It's a blazing fast hardcore record that feels light years ahead of its time. Gauze feels like this came out in the late 90s, early 2000s. Like, this record is so ahead of the game. There are elements of early American hardcore from DC and LA. You can hear plenty of D-beat, like you would hear on the post-crass UK punk scene. This Gauze album may be the closest album from 1986 to sounding like it could come out today in 2022. Crash the Pose has a really great fun shouted chant intro that just hooks you immediately. You get a sort of melodic intro on Kate ni Sarase. I think that's track 3 on the album. Gauze would be massively influential to bands in the Japanese hardcore scene and other bands like Drop Dead here in the States. Maximum Rock and Roll said, "Japan's answer to non-stop chaotic destruction, finely tuned and well-mixed with great backup choruses, throwing chunks of havoc everywhere." They would go on to release Where's the Limit in 1989, Wash Your Face and Come Back Again in 1997, Ride the Fidgety Rhythm in 2007, and 2021, an album that I can't find a translation for that makes sense. It's very long. It's in kanji. The last, like, 3 albums or 4 albums they did were all in kanji. So Google Translate's kind of where people get the names from. And in 1997, bassist Shin told Maximum Rock and Roll, "To be honest, if one of the members quit, it wouldn't be Gauze anymore. We never change the members. It's not because how good they play, but how they think or feel about these things." So yeah, Gauze, legends in Japan, influences around the world. Crust and D-Beat owe so much to them. Yeah, it's just a really cool record. I definitely think you should listen to it, or at least hear some songs from it, because it's definitely way ahead of everyone else. I was trying to think of what other records came out in 86 that I was like, yeah, this is ahead of its game. And like the closest I thought was like Dag Nasty's record that year. It feels ahead of the game, but also not, it doesn't go up to the present. Like that type of emo core, melodic hardcore is not the same or as common now. Whereas Gauze's like crust and D-beat sound, you can hear tons of bands today that are borrow heavily from them. So yeah, probably the most futuristic sounding band on here. Moving on to number 3 on here. It is They Might Be Giants by They Might Be Giants.
Don't don't let's start. This is the worst part. Could believe for all the world that you're my precious little girl. But don't let's start. I've got a weak heart and I don't get around. How you get around?
The band formed in Brooklyn, New York in 1982. Originally consisting of just John Flansburgh and John Linnell, they would perform as a duo along with the drum machine before later creating a full band. John and John met as teenagers in Lincoln, Massachusetts. They wrote songs but didn't become a band until they moved to Brooklyn. In 1985, they released a Flexi 7-inch called Wiggle Diskette that featured early demos. They also released a self-titled demo cassette that same year, which leads us to the self-titled album. This is their debut full-length, sometimes called the Pink Album. The album was released November 4th, 1986 on Bar None Records. The personnel on this album is John Flansburgh on vocals, guitar, bass, and harmonica, and John Linnell on vocals, keys, accordion, sax, and synth bass. The album was produced by Bill Krause. The singles for this album were Hotel Detective and Don't Let's Start. Don't Let's Start is probably the biggest song on the album, and the one that gave them their first hints of success. That song became a college radio hit a year after the song was released, and it helped get the attention of Elektra Records. It is tempting to call They Might Be Giants a joke or a comedy band, because nearly every song is centered around some form of absurdist humor, but the focus on high-quality songwriting really makes them more than a silly joke band. If these songs weren't about the ridiculous things that they are about, and just regular lyrics that you would hear from any other band, these songs would still rule. The album sold 10,000 copies in its first year. Robert Christgau gave the album an A. Trouser Press said, "The Giants' debut album is diabolically clever and wildly eclectic, a romp of fully realized masterpieces that could not possibly fail to entertain even the fussiest, hardest-hearted idiot." Spin in 1987 said, "And a first listen to the merry Dada lyrics and peppy rhythms from forgotten game shows will make you think you found a bona fide smart boy novelty record. Something more intelligent than Sparks, good, but not as stupid as the Beastie Boys, bad." Why are you taking shots at the Beastie Boys? I love the Beastie Boys. I mean, maybe in 87 they weren't the smartest lyricists at the time, but I think people misunderstood the Beastie Boys lyrics on that first record anyway. They were kind of making fun of the people that they appear to be. And anyway, this isn't a Beastie Boys podcast. AllMusic said, "While there are a lot of geeky jokes and barely developed ideas scattered throughout the album, the sheer kaleidoscopic array of styles is intoxicating, and it helps the best songs stand out in sharp relief." John and John said in a Spin interview in 2015, "We had a very weird relationship to MTV. They played Put Your Hand Inside the Puppet Head, which made no sense at all. We didn't have anything behind it. We didn't have a publicist. We didn't have a record company. We were the most stoppable force in rock music. But I think back then, for a lot of people who were in these weird gatekeeper positions of power, pushing us forward was a way for them to actually have input in what went on in the world." So, I first became aware of They Might Be Giants when I was a kid. I have no idea where or how I heard their name. I just knew it. Maybe I'd read it somewhere. Maybe I just heard someone say it. I have no idea. Not my parents. They wouldn't have listened to this band. I wound up checking out Flood from the library and loved it. I probably checked it out a couple times, honestly. Then I would later check out their albums Lincoln, Apollo 18, and John Henry. And then many years later, I would check out The Spine. So They Might Be Giants is very much a library band for me, because that was how I found a lot of music when I was younger. It wouldn't be until I was able to really start downloading music regularly that I would hear this record. So, for the show, this is not the first time I've heard the album. In fact, I've listened to this album many times before. In the past, I've kind of done a version of this where I looked at the year 1986 and tried to find the records that I liked from that year. And this was always near the top of that list. So I wasn't entirely sure if I was ever going to do it on the show, but listening to it, I was like, man, I've not given this album much of a fair shake when it comes to talking about on the podcast, so that's why I chose it. And, you know, revisiting it again for the show, it's still one of my favorite records from 1986. It's still one of my all-time favorites from this year. Something may knock it off eventually, but I was amazed at how fully formed their sound was immediately on the first song of this album. The album's 19 tracks, it's 45 minutes long. It's not as refined as the next records would be, but all of the elements are there. They're not searching for their sound. The sound is here. They Might Be Giants is They Might Be Giants from the first record to the last record. The only thing that changes is production and maybe like songwriting quality. Like they just get better as songwriters. There's a couple songs on here that they don't work quite as well. There are no bad tracks though. I like everything on this album. Put Your Hand Inside the Puppet Head is one of the standout tracks from this record. It's got this really fun upbeat melody and this kind of cool percussive elements. Number 3 is the third track on the album, and it is talking about how they only have 2 songs in me, and now they had to write the third. It's like a hoedown country style song, and it's so funny to think they were like, uh-oh, we're out of songs already, and it's our third song. And then they would go on to release the massive discography that they have. They definitely have more than 2 songs in them. Hideaway Folk Family is a lovely little gentle melody. She's an Angel and Youth Culture Killed My Dog are some of my favorite tracks on the album. And yeah, they would release their second album Lincoln in 1988 and their breakthrough album Flood in 1990. They would eventually release 23 albums to date, including their most recent one, Book, in 2021. When I was younger, I loved They Might Be Giants because they were silly and they made me laugh. Just goofy, absurdist humor. One of my all-time favorite bands as a kid, Fiver and Frenzy, also had silly, absurdist lyrics, so I saw a lot of similarity there. When I got older, I was like, okay, yeah, this is just a silly joke band. You know, I didn't really, like, listen to them that much. Probably in my 20s, I would say. But then I picked up a cassette copy of Flood from Goodwill, and I put it in my car because, like, the car I was driving at the time had a tape deck in it, and I would use an adapter to a CD player to listen to stuff I'd burned. But occasionally I would just be like, I just want a couple tapes to leave in the car in case my, like, batteries die on my CD player or something like that. So I would keep Flood in the car, but when I would put it in to listen to it, I would leave it in, and I'd probably go a couple days just kind of like cycling through Flood over and over again, like anytime I got in the car. And it was then that I kind of realized, I was like, man, so they're not just a silly band, but the lyrics, not the lyrics, but the music is so good. The melodies on that record are phenomenal. So I definitely was like, okay, the Immortal Giants is a better band than I remember. Maybe, you know, they're not just a joke band. So over the time, I've listened to more and more of their stuff. I check out new stuff when it comes out. I almost always enjoy it. I think the 80s and 90s material is probably the best, but the newer stuff isn't bad. But yeah, this record's great. There's so many good songs on here. Don't Let's Start is phenomenal. It's probably the best song on all the records that I'm talking about today. I love They Might Be Giants. Moving on. Up next, it is Born Sandy Devotional by the Triffids. Triffids formed in Perth, Australia in 1976 while members David McComb and Alzie McDonald were in high school, and they started under the name Dalzy, a mixture of David and Alzie. They added Phil Kakulis to the band and changed their name to Block Music, and then to the name Logic, which they kept for one day before becoming the Triffids. They named their band after the novel The Day of the Triffids. And between 1978 and 1981, they released 6 self-released cassettes. They're called like first, second, fourth, you know, like that kind of, they're just numbered. They released their first single, Stand Up, in 1981, and then a 4-track EP called Reverie in 1982. In 1983, they released Bad Timing and Other Stories, and they released their first full-length album, Treeless Plain, that same year. In 1984, they released the Lawson Square Infirmary and Raining Pleasure EPs. Then the band relocated to England in 1984 and found the success they were hoping for. They wound up opening for Echo and the Bunnymen on tour, as well as the Monochrome set. Weirdly, they were unable to find a major label, though, to put out their next record. But they headed into the studio anyway and recorded their sophomore album, Born Sandy Devotional. This record was released March 24th, 1985, on White Hot Records in Australia and Hot Records in the UK and US. The personnel on this album is David McComb on guitar, vocals, and keys, Evil Graham Lee on pedal and lap steel guitar, Martin Casey on bass, Jill Burt on keys and vocals, Robert McComb on violin and guitar, and Alzie McDonald on drums. The record was produced by the band and Gil Norton, who had previously worked with Echo and the Bunnymen. The album peaked at number 27 on the UK album charts, number 37 on the Australian charts, and number 18 on the Swedish charts. The Swedes love the Triffids. The single for this record is Wide Open Road. It's the only single for this album, and it became their most important single. The album was featured on an Australian series called Greatest Australian Albums in 2007. It was ranked number 5 in the book The 100 Best Australian Albums. ABC, the Australian broadcast station, said on their website, "Although acknowledged critically as an important Australian album, this record still feels underappreciated. With its rich sounds and poetic lyrical imagery, it truly sets itself apart as a uniquely Australian record. 3 decades on, Born Sandy Devotional still looms large as a defining musical document." AllMusic said, "This is the most accomplished work from McCombs' tragically short career, encapsulating his talent for creating a lyrical and musical resonance between the stark, isolated geography of Western Australia and universally recognizable, desolate interior landscapes." The Guardian said, "Over eerily majestic guitars and strings and darkly anthemic tunes, McComb unloads tales of lives being lost in wide open spaces." So the Triffids were a complete unknown to me. I saw their name on a list of albums that came out in 1986. I assume they were just another UK jangle pop band, like so many Smiths wannabes that existed at this time. I was pleasantly surprised to hear I was very wrong. Songwriting on this band is incredible. There's a lot of country elements to the guitar work on here, and I think it's very interesting to hear Australian transplants to England interpret country music, because country is a very American sound. David McComb's voice is so strong and smooth, and it kind of reminds me of a gentler Nick Cave, or maybe even an Ian Astbury. The standout tracks for me is the mildly tropical Estuary Bed, the high-energy Chicken Killer, and the melancholic Lonely Stretch. Lonely Stretch might be my favorite song on the record, even though it doesn't quite represent the album as a whole. It's a slower track. The Triffids would return to Australia and record their follow-up album, In the Pines, also released in 1986, so maybe I'll get to it. Then Kalincher in 1987, and their final album, The Black Swan, in 1989. The band would wind up breaking up that same year. Unfortunately, David McComb had a pretty rough life post The Triffids. He suffered a crushed vertebrae in 1986 that gave him chronic back pain. He also suffered from substance abuse problems that caused him to have a heart transplant in 1996. Then in 1999, he was in a severe car accident that he passed away from 3 days later. He was only 37 years old. Shockingly hard life. I assume the back pain led to his heroin use, and then the heroin use led to his heart transplant, which also, they say, accounted for his death. You know, his body just couldn't handle it when he got into that wreck. The band would occasionally reunite to play live performances in tribute to David, and there's lots of articles about the Triffids, especially around like 2006, which is when they did their first like big reissues around the world. I think that's where a lot of people who weren't familiar with them from the 80s really got to hear them, especially in places like here in the United States. You know, I mentioned the UK and Australia and Sweden all being pretty big places for them, but I don't think they really made much of a mark here. I couldn't find much as far as like magazine articles or about them here. Not until we get into the internet age where you see like articles around the reissues. But it's just a really great record. I think Dylan talked about their first album on our Patreon episode, I'm Listening, not too long ago. I haven't heard that album, but I'm sure it's great. Oh boy, my voice is not having a great time with this one, but I'm going to power through. Okay, our final album we are talking about today. It is Poison Love by Blood on the Saddle. Blood on the Saddle is a Los Angeles-based country punk band, originally formed in 1983. Upon seeing the Gun Club play with the Cramps and X, Greg Davis wanted to form a band. Imagine that lineup. Gun Club, Cramps, and X in like 83 or 82? That lineup is... that's amazing. That's probably... that'd be one of the best shows I would ever see. Greg Davis would then meet Annette Zelinskis at a Blasters show, and then they started singing together, doing some Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, like, style songs together. Not really forming a band. Davis then moved to New Orleans to play dobro in a bluegrass band, and then to Nashville to learn more about traditional country music, before returning to L.A. to form a band that merges punk rock with American traditional music. Annette stayed in L.A., and she played in a band called The Bangs. So while Annette was on tour with The Bangs, Davis formed a trio to play in L.A. The Bangs changed their name to The Bangles, and when Annette returned to L.A., she joined Blood on the Saddle. The Bangles signed to CBS Records, and Annette chose to quit and focus on Blood on the Saddle. Annette, you may have made the wrong choice. I don't know. Bangles rule, and she could have got some of that money, but she didn't. She chose to play in a cowpunk band. So the band recorded and released their self-titled full-length on the Minutemen's record label New Alliance. They then signed a provisional contract with MCA in 1985, but the label rejected their demo. So they were just like, no, we don't like this. See you later. So this gets us to the second LP, Poison Love. The person on this album is Ron Botelho on bass, Herman Sinek on drums, Greg Davis on guitar, banjo, and vocals, and Annette Zelinskis on vocals and harmonica. It was released on Chameleon Records in the U.S., Stiff Records in the U.K., and New Rose in Europe. They would tour America, Canada, and Europe in support. Trouser Press has said, Poison Love refines the group's stylistic balance, clarifying the energetic country rock side while reducing the first album's more wanton rock impulses. The resulting crossbreed is easygoing and colorful, a post-adolescent barn dance with enough electricity to make a deep impression and enough credible cultural resonance to survive the style mongering. Is that a positive review? I guess so. They're saying they do it well. So I mentioned Blood on the Saddle not too long ago on a Patreon where I discussed their first album, the self-titled in 1984. They play a more country-leaning version of cowpunk, which they're in similar company as X, the Blasters, and the Flesh Eaters, but way more country and bluegrass. This record is so much fun. The first five tracks are just unstoppable. It's like a perfect run of tracks. Five amazing tracks. Once you get past it, there's like a demo version. It's like the sixth track of a song, at least on the Spotify version that I listened to. And then they have a lot of other good songs on the back half of the album, but just like that, those first five are perfect. The opening track, Promise Your Heart to Me, is a raucous cowboy song with a fun chorus and a really fun guitar solo. Police Siren is a funny track about being pulled over by the cops, and A Bed of Roses has a ranchero feel to it. So the second half isn't as strong, but it does feature a cover of the traditional song In the Pines, and they would release their third album in 1987, Fresh Blood. This is the band's original lineup, and they would break up that year due to the final record not really selling that well. Greg Davis would revive the name, I think, and even as early as 88, and play with various other artists throughout the years. They would record albums. They would all be delayed by multiple years. I found that really weird. They had one that came out in 2021 that they recorded in 2013. And they have like three records like that, where it was like years between recording and release. I assume that's based on them trying to find, you know, labels. I think Blood on the Saddle are probably one of the more underrated bands from this time period. I never see their name brought up. I never see them on lists of like cowpunk bands. And it's shocking because they're so good. These songs are amazing. They're very bluegrass and country inspired, but also have that punk edge. You can tell they're just like kind of these like grungy punks. So, so good. Their third record came out on SST. So that gives you an idea of, you know, if the Minutemen and Greg Ginn are like, this band rules, you should check them out. It's really it's the most fun record on this week's episode. There's just so many really great songs on there. You should check it out if you're a fan of that kind of music, for sure. Oh, but that is it. My voice has held out as long as I think it can. Whew, it's going to be a long week of recording for me, unfortunately. I'm recording next week's episode tomorrow from when I'm recording this one. And then I'll probably have to try and record a Patreon audio, too. Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully my voice tomorrow is much better than my voice today, but we'll see. I'll have other people to talk to on the episode tomorrow. But thank you so much. Please let me know if you've enjoyed this. I'd love to hear feedback on these episodes. They're a blast for me to do. I'm loving digging through 1986. I'm loving, like, researching deep into the band's stories and histories and finding as much writing from the time period about them as I can. I prefer to find stuff written around the time the records came out and not so much, like, later stuff. But, like, with the Triffids record, it's just too hard to find anything. And I found, like, little to no writing about Blood on the Saddle. But thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on all forms of social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, if it still exists, at PunkLottoPod. Should we make a PunkLottoPod Hive? Dylan and I made Hive accounts. Maybe I will when Twitter actually dies. Hive's weird. Hive's not very good. Dylan described it as like MySpace trying to load on DSL. It's a very slow website, and there's barely anybody on it that I know. So we'll see. Maybe if Twitter finally fully crashes, then more people will migrate over, but we'll wait. You can email us at punklottopod@gmail.com, and we have a voicemail line, which is 202-688-PUNK. We are coming up on the end of year, so it's time to start getting your albums of 2022 ready. And I think if you want to call and tell us your favorite albums of the year, leave us a voicemail and we'll play it on the show. We'd love to hear it. And if you're also interested, you can head over to our Patreon. I mentioned it a few times on the show. It just kind of randomly wasn't topic. It was related to what I was talking about. But if you go to patreon.com/punklottopod, for $1, you get access to all of our weekly bonus audio. This includes the I'm Listenings, our chart dives. We've done movie reviews on there. I do this series called Moon Buys for Misfits, where I make videos trying out drinks. There's some writing on there. Not a ton of that. Speaking of writing, you can go to substack.com/punklottopod or punklottopod.substack.com, however that website works. But yeah, so this week on the Patreon, the regular bonus audio will not be up on Wednesday, but the new series that I'm working on that I really hope I can continue to do will start on Thursday. And I'm not going to give it away here, but it's one of the dumbest decisions I may have made when it comes to this podcast and ideas and what I want to try and do. So look forward to that. I'll be plugging that on social media. So yeah, I think it's a bad idea and I don't think I'm going to finish it, but we'll start it. All right, thank you everyone so much for listening. My voice is done. It's had it. I can't go on much longer. So thank you everyone. Please leave us feedback, leave us reviews on iTunes, whatever it is that your podcasting device, whatever you like to rate on. Thank you so much, and we will see you next week.